From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in Los Angeles in the spring of 2016. It was the annual conference of the Associated Writers and Writing Programs. And a Rochesterian named Stephen Huff flagged a taxi and began a conversation with his driver, who was Iranian. The driver asked what the conference was about and then asked, "You mean there are poets there?" And as Huff recounts the story, he talked to the driver about an Iranian poet, Omar Khayyam. Huff recited a few verses from the Rubaiyat, and the driver was thrilled. And then the driver said something that would stay with Stephen Huff. The driver said that in Iran, many people make pilgrimage to the tombs of great writers. Huff thought about the kinds of pilgrimages people make in the United States. Gettysburg, sure. Graceland. Washington, D.C. There are some graves that are destinations, but not too many. And why is that? Do we fear death in the United States more intensely? Do cemeteries make us feel uneasy? Huff writes, quote, "Here, some never visit the graves of their grandparents and other elders. In fact, among the things that people of older countries find puzzling in America are our disconnection from our history and a passivity toward our ancestors. Some know little about their great-grandparents. Many could not name a living American poet, far less a dead one. Yet I think if we did recognize those singers and storytellers and cultural shamans who came before us, if we noted not only what they wrote, when they lived, and where their remains went to rest, it would help us preserve a sense of ourselves, instill a sense of lineage in our young and wavering culture," end quote. And so Steve Huff set out to do something about it. He's traveled to dozens of grave sites across New York State, and he's created a blog, a website called In Our Home Ground. He hopes that collecting the stories, visiting the grave sites, and even just the sparse images that you'll find of headstones will inspire a sense of wonder in all of us. It might even inspire us to travel and commune like he has. He's been giving public presentations about his travels. He's got another one coming up in Brighton. But first, Stephen Huff, my guest on Connections, the creator of the In Our Home Ground blog. And I have really enjoyed the stories. Thank you very much for being here.
Oh, thank you. Glad to be here.
And also with us is Chris Clemens, the creator of Exploring Upstate. We asked Chris to come in because I think there's some overlap in some of the themes here. And it's a lot of fun talking to you about your work as well. Thanks for being here, Chris.
Yeah, thanks, Evan. Good to be back.
All right. So brief hello from producer Megan Mack. Yeah?
Hello,
oh,
yes,
I just
I'm
want to make
here.
Sure you're ready back. I can't
oh,
see
I'm here.
You.
I know
I
the monitors. The monitors are always
I want to make
blocking.
Sure you had the microphone. Hi.
Hi, yes, we are in day two of our winter membership drive, even though yesterday felt like spring. It is February, and so we are asking for your help to keep programs like Connections on the air here at WXXI. It's a quick phone call to 454-6300 to pledge your dollars of support. Any gift helps. Any gift keeps us going. We have been on the air here for WXXI for decades and decades, and we want to keep that going. If you call now, great time to call because we are in the middle of a dollar-for-dollar challenge. Thanks to a member in Canandaigua who has been a supporter of WXXI for more than 25 years. I don't know if they've been listening to Connections for 25 years.
When I took the reins here, the great Bob Smith had been there for 25 years, so now 30.
Very good.
Now 30 for this program.
Well, we remember Bob, and we consider what Connections is today. If you value all that programming, 454-6300 to keep these conversations going.
All right. Thank you, Megan Mack. And a lot to talk about this hour. This is such a fun idea. And listeners, if you can right now, jump online and check it out as we kind of hit some of the different sites and these stories that you're going to hear this hour. The website is inourhomeground.wordpress.com. Do I have it right, Steve? That's
yes,
correct?
That's okay. Right.
And so take me to that conversation with the Iranian cab driver. I mean, what do you remember from that?
Well, he said that in Iran we make pilgrimages to Omar Khayyam's tomb. He said, you know, he was an atheist, but we still go to his tomb.
And you're thinking about the United States, but that it probably took you some time to really formulate the mission. How did the full mission of what you're doing come about?
Well, the idea, another part of that idea came to me when I was talking to the poet Robert Darling, who's teaches at Keuka College, and he told me that Paul Bowles, the author of The Sheltering Sky, is buried in the Finger Lakes, and that kind of startled me because he lived almost his whole adult life in Tangier. So what was he doing buried up there? And I looked into it and found that that his grandparents had had a summer home up there, and he had spent a lot of time up there as a boy. And so when he died, he went to a family plot up there. But it made me think about upstaters are probably not very conscious of our literary heritage. And I thought that, well, maybe I could do something about that. We are often, in literary terms at least, we're kind of in the shadow of the icons of New York City. So I decided that I would do this project. I wouldn't include New York City. And I thought I was going to wrap it up in a year, but I kept finding more and more authors that are buried up here. And now it's been 3 years.
And you've done how many?
About 35 communities, but that's well over 60 or 70 writers.
Yeah, and so I'll just mention, listeners, here are some of the names that we'll talk about. And we can't talk about every single one, obviously, this hour, but Mark Twain, John Gardner, James Fenimore Cooper, Rod Serling, Carl Sagan, I want to talk to you about that, Louise Brooks, Arch Merrill, in Rochester, there's so much, Susan B. Anthony, of course, Frederick Douglass, Lewis Henry Morgan, Adelaide and Algernon Crapsey, Edward Crone, Lillian Wald, there's so much here. It's like the cemetery version of exploring upstate, isn't it? What did you think, Chris, when you saw this?
So I woke up one morning in early November and had a notification from a friend who said, hey, this event sounds like something you'd be into. And it was a notification about an event that Steve was doing at Writers and Books. And it was a lecture of about the whole project. And I looked at it and I thought, yeah, that's totally me. because much like Steve mentioned, I do often feel that it's... maybe slightly unfortunate that we're sometimes in the shadow of New York City, not even just in terms of literary awareness, but a lot of things, food, entertainment, history, all that stuff. So a lot of what I've always done is tried to focus on the things that in upstate that are
art,
so great.
Yeah, yeah.
And having grown up in Rochester, there are people who, like you just mentioned, Arch Merrill, who have always been heroes of mine, who have done a lot of the same things that I'm attempting to do now. And I sat in Steve's lecture that night in Writers and Books, and I thought, oh my God, I've been at this for a very long time now, and still he was blowing my mind about things that I didn't realize, one of which was Arch Merrill. So he agreed to meet me at Brighton Cemetery. It turns out, actually, you probably have a connection to this. The diamond grape, the creator of the diamond grape, Jacob Moore, did that on Clover Street right near Elmwood Ave.
And I did not know that story.
Yeah. So he created maybe four hybrid grapes. So he's buried in Brighton Cemetery in an unmarked grave. Mm-hmm. And I've been there multiple times to find it. I've walked right past Arch Merrill's grave and I never knew it was there until I met Steve.
when you think about that experience, walking past Arch Merrill, when you start looking at the pictures of the grave sites on Steve's site, most of them are not mausoleums. Most of them, I think Lewis Henry Morgan is, but most of them are not.
His is ornate, yeah.
Yeah, but but otherwise, you know, they're pretty sparse.
Modest.
Yes, that's a good word for it. So I'm going to read. I want to read the quote that we've shared several times on this program recently, but I think it really resonates today, and I want to get our guest's thoughts on this. It was recently that. In an interview, late night host Conan O'Brien was giving about, you know, sort of whether his program is changing and what happens if he retires. And he basically told the interviewer, when I retire, like, people will forget me instantly. It's not a big deal. And they said, no. And then he said the following. He says, this is going to sound grim, but eventually all our graves go unattended. He said, sorry, Calvin Coolidge was a pretty popular president. I've been to his grave in Vermont. It has the presidential seal on it. Nobody was there. And then he says, I had a great conversation with Albert Brooks once. When I met him for the first time, I was kind of stammering. I said, you make movies. They live on forever. I just do these late night shows. They get lost. They're never seen again. And who cares? And he looked at me and he said, what are you talking about? None of it matters. I said, none of it matters? And he said, no, that's the secret. In 1940, people said Clark Gable is the face of the 20th century. Who thinks about Clark Gable anymore? It doesn't matter. You'll be forgotten. I'll be forgotten. We'll all be forgotten, end quote. So that's a nice way to open the hour.
But wonderful Tuesday.
Yes, happy Tuesday, everybody. But in many ways, Steve, I have to think that sort of may land with some accuracy. When you go to these grave sites, these amazing people who... what goes through your mind?
They are modest stones in almost all cases, and a lot of times several other people are buried in the same spot, and they're sharing a stone with a number of other people. But But sometimes they are unattended, and I've cleaned a lot of them off. I've scraped the lichen off of them. I've pulled the weeds around them. I was going to pull the weeds around Daniel Berrigan's grave, and then I decided he probably would like them, so I left them.
Why is that?
It's just the kind of guy he was. He was such a natural individual. He was a very comfortable kind of guy. I shared a bus seat with him many, many, many years ago, very much by happenstance. I was riding back from New York City, and I was pretty disappointed. I'd tried to be a singer and hadn't worked out. On the way back, we stopped in Poughkeepsie, and this priest was getting off on the bus, and all these people were shaking his hand and seeing him off. I knew he was a kind of, whoever he was an unusual guy. And he came back and he took the only seat left on the bus, because in those days, people were kind of reluctant to sit next to a hippie. But he sat next to me, and we talked for a little while. We talked about the Vietnam War protests going on. And he asked me what I was doing, and I told him about my bad luck, and he was sympathetic. Then I had no idea who he was. For all I knew, he was just another priest. But then a few days later, I saw his picture in the paper and realized that I'd been riding with Daniel Berrigan for about 100 miles and didn't know it.
Okay. And so for listeners who've never heard the name, what do you want them to know about that career?
Daniel Berrigan was probably best known as an anti-war activist. He was represented the Catholic left, I think. But he wrote a lot of books on theology as well. And he was a Lamont Prize-winning poet, which was really something. That's one of the highest prizes that a poet can win in the United States. Well, it was called a Lamont. Now it's called the Lachlan Award, but it's the same award. And he won it. And so he had a very, very wide range as an author. Probably, I don't know, I think the book that I enjoyed reading most was Night Flight to Hanoi, where he was, he and Howard Zinn, the leftist historian, were given the job of flying to Hanoi to receive a couple of American fighter pilots that North Vietnam was willing to release, but only to people involved in the peace movement. So Howard Zinn and Daniel Berrigan went to Hanoi, collected these two men, but when the plane landed in Thailand on the way back, American representatives came on, the army came on and got these guys, and because they weren't about to allow that plane to land at Andrews Air Force Base or someplace like that. And these guys get off the plane with a couple of peaceniks.
Where is he buried?
In Orrysville, which is interesting. Orrysville is a little bit to the east of Syracuse, almost to Amsterdam. It's the big Jesuit place, and it's where he went originally when he wanted to become a priest, as his when he was still a teenager. They rejected him the first time he came back again. And that's where he's buried. That's where most Jesuits, priests are buried there, I think. And it's easy to find. Actually, the place itself isn't easy to find, but once you're there, the cemetery is very easy to find.
Yeah, but in a moment, I'm going to ask about the criteria, how Steve decided which writers, which poets to include for this exploration of upstate New York for his site. And again, it's inourhomeground.wordpress.com to check some of these things out here. Do we have a strange relationship as Americans with cemeteries, do you think?
I believe so, yes.
You think we do?
I think we do.
We view them as sort of, instead of viewing them as sort of either sacred, and I'm sure people do. I mean, I'm super generalizing here.
Mm-hmm.
But often the first word that comes to mind, if you were playing Family Feud, what's a word that comes to mind when you think of cemeteries? People would say creepy.
Yes.
Most often that would be what is said as over sacred, beautiful, special, peaceful. Mm-hmm. How do you think of cemetery?
Well, I think of them as, especially since I've been working on this project, as part of our history, part of our social history.
Yeah.
And I know we do have a strange relationship to cemeteries, but because I think more people are afraid of ghosts than will admit it.
The whole ghost thing is a whole other show. I'm going to hold my tongue as best I can. Chris, do we have a strange relationship with that, with cemeteries, do you think?
Yeah. So to say Americans might be difficult because I think it probably depends on what kind of cemeteries you have where you live. I think a lot of people in Rochester, where we're all living, probably have a different reverence for cemeteries because we have some really wonderful ones like Mount Hope. The history there, the serene beauty of a park almost, that was the original intention for Mount Hope, I think probably has withstood the test of generations of people living in Rochester who really enjoy exploring in that cemetery. I don't know if that's the case everywhere.
Well, in the case of the work of finding gravesites, there are some at Mount Hope, I mean, that everybody knows.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
There's some, like you just mentioned, in, you say Orrysville, is that the town?
Yes, Orrysville.
I mean, there are certain authors and poets who you decide that you want to focus on, and you probably have no idea. What was the hardest one to find?
The hardest one
I mean, some
to
of it's
find.
A bit like a treasure hunt.
They are, you know. I have to leave time, you know, when I get to the website ancestry.com or findagrave.com will get you to the cemetery, but then you're on your own. I've spent hours sometimes walking up and down and up and down. If you're lucky, there's an office that's open and they'll help you. Or that maybe findagrave.com will sometimes include the picture of a gravestone, and which helps.
I think to some degree our listeners might think that there's something, are we allowed to do this? And the answer is yes, of course we can, right?
Oh, yes.
This is our history.
That's right.
You can do this. So I'm going to start the hour with a phone call from a listener who already has a name in mind that I did want to talk about. There's
okay.
a lot of different names that I'm excited to talk about with our guests here. This is David in, and we're going to see if you can guess what he's going to bring up, in Ithaca.
Oh.
Go ahead, David.
Hi. I live in Aurora, but I'm house-sitting in Ithaca, and Ithaca is where Carl Sagan is buried, and I came across his grave almost by mistake. It's right below Sunset Park, which is a really interesting park that overlooks the whole area here on the hill, and just a few thousand yards down the road is the cemetery, and there's Carl Sagan, and alongside his very modest in-ground buried plaque. People left notebooks and pens and pencils and stuff with a few scribbled pieces of paper saying how they appreciated Carl Sagan. And I want to just say one thing good about graveyards is they're great places for a date. I used to take my girlfriend there and I even got laid once. In the
Great places for a date.
Yes.
Maybe a second or a third.
Yes, I was saying that is not what I expected, David. But thank you. You know, I suppose if the hospital is closed, the cemetery is a great place for it.
Carl Sagan has the most decorated grave I've seen.
By people, fans, you mean?
By fans, mementos left there. The second most decorated is Rod Serling's up in Interlaken, but. Kind of, it's a little more touching in some ways. Some people leave him a pack of cigarettes, which is what killed him.
Carl Sagan?
No.
Rod Serling. And by the way, just because I feel like even though we're touching on big names and it's obvious, Carl Sagan, known for many, many scientific contributions, the first iteration of the TV show Cosmos,
that's right.
Many different pieces of great writing, and frankly was one of the most influential scientific thinkers and educators in our country's history. So buried in Ithaca,
right.
Was it easy to find?
Yeah, he's in Lakeview Cemetery, which is near the lake, and a little bit northeast of Ithaca. It's mostly on a hill. You need local direction to get there because it's difficult to get in there. There's these dirt paths that go into there that you can drive in, but it's tight. But it's once you're there, you'll see a black chain fence near the top of the hill, and he's right next to his parents.
And you saw the most fan memorabilia there, Serling maybe second. So what were some of the things you saw at Carl Sagan's grave?
Oh, just rocks, stones, trinkets, things of that sort. Yes.
Sometimes people will leave notes. It's always interesting. And on your blog, again, it's inourhomeground.wordpress.com, you take a picture of each gravesite.
That's right.
And it's really neat to see that because there's quite an interesting range, but most that I've seen are pretty modest. And to me, there's something spiritual about that. You don't have to be a religious person, at least I don't feel that you do, to feel something spiritual about even seeing the picture. Though in a moment, I want to ask both of our guests about the difference between experiencing something, well, I Googled it, I read it online, versus going there, because that's both of what you do. Mm-hmm. Do you feel any sense of spiritualism when you're, spiritualism is a different thing, Fox Sisters, spirituality, any sort of a spiritual connection when you're at these sites?
I feel a sense of awe.
Yeah.
Sometimes, often, actually, yeah.
What's the difference between going there in person and whether it's a restaurant, a gravesite, a piece of art? I mean, Chris, part of what you've been doing for years now is documenting, and going in person has got to be very, very different than just reading about it online.
It's completely different for a bunch of different reasons. And oftentimes, if I identify something by using Google or something on the internet from the comfort of my couch, I've identified a place that I want to go, and that becomes sort of my B destination from my A. But all the stuff in between there, I'm not able to find on Google, and sometimes there's things that I wouldn't have stumbled upon if I didn't actually go see it in person. But I think the other thing that's important is having an understanding of those surroundings. And you were talking a little bit about spirituality or a sense of spirit. I think that as a result, my connection to a sense of place in upstate New York is more secure. I can't drive down Route 89 along Cayuga Lake without thinking, that's Rod Serling right over there. And as a result, I feel more at home everywhere I go in upstate New York because these things are familiar to me.
You feel physically connected, not just knowing of something, but having...
Yeah, physically connected, but also I think a sense of there's a sense of spirit there for me.
Okay. And how do you feel about those moments where you finally arrive? I mean, these are writers that you've appreciated, and you're finally arriving where they are laid to rest.
No, it just feels like the end of a journey. a lot of reading and thinking and plotting and how am I going to find this guy or how am I going to find this one, and it often ends with a sense of awe.
Rod Serling in Interlaken, which is Cayuga Lake, north of Ithaca on the west side.
On the west side.
And Rod Serling died at the age is 50. Is that was
50
he
years old?
50 years old.
In fact, he died at Strong here.
Died at Strong Memorial Hospital. Yeah. I read it on your website. And he, I think he had a couple of different episodes in the same week and then passed away at Strong when he was in Rochester. Mm-hmm. Of course, the creator of The Twilight Zone.
And also he wrote some of the finest teleplays that we've ever had on television. The one he's most famous for is Requiem for a Heavyweight.
Do you think The Twilight Zone is more tame than some of his other stuff as well?
Yeah, he was trying to work with television. There's a good interview with him trying to think of who he was being interviewed by, but he said that
it's like 1959. You mentioned
that time, and the question was, how are you able to work with censorship? And he said, he's just hanging in there because he knows it's a great medium and he knows it's important, and so he's just going to stick with it. And he did, you know, he's sticking.
So you can find Rod Serling and his gravesite in Interlaken in New York. So in a moment, we're going to get our only break of the hour. In our second half hour, we're going to talk a lot more about where Stephen Huff, the creator of the In Our Home Ground blog, has gone. And we're going to take you right here in Rochester, some of the names and sites you're going to find and what they experience there. And we're going to talk to Steve and Chris about just putting these journeys together and actually deciding to go do it, to commune in that way. I just have such admiration for the work that they have done. It's really interesting. And by the way, if you want to head out to an event, I mentioned it at the top of the hour, you're doing Brighton Public Library next week, is that right?
That's right, next Tuesday.
What's going on?
I'm showing a PowerPoint slideshow of the graves and the grave sites and talking about each one and the authors and the work and why they're important.
That's in Brighton Public Library next Tuesday, that's February 12th, 12:30 p.m. Mm-hmm. during Connections.
Oh, I tried.
Steve, we've got to talk about promoting here. Let's get our only break of the hour. Stephen Huff and Chris Clemens are guests here, and we're going to come back to talk a lot more about the authors, poets, writers, gravesites, and what Steve experienced when he found them. That's coming up next. I'm Evan Dawson. Wednesday on The Next Connections, one of our favorite guests, astrophysicist Adam Frank, joins us. He joins us to discuss a new piece he's written about what he calls science's blind spot. He says science is great, but it's missing one big thing. What is that? He explains first hour. Then in our second hour, Governor Cuomo wants to ban the release of mugshots. Should we do it? Talk with you Wednesday. Welcome back to Connections. It was almost just 3 years ago that Stephen Huff, who is a writer himself, was at a conference in L.A., and the thought came into his mind after a conversation with an Iranian cab driver that, you know, in Iran, they make pilgrimages to the site of great writers, great poets. What if I took the time to go to the dozens of gravesites of writers, poets in upstate New York? Some household names, some not, but maybe once were, or maybe Steve thinks they should be. And you had to come up with some criteria. You had to come up with a set of standards on who made the cut. How did you create that criteria?
That was difficult, but I finally decided they have to be, an author has to be, has to have written a book or a screenplay or a teleplay. So if you're writing articles, articles in magazines alone wouldn't get, I had to cut it off somewhere. So a book or a screenplay or a teleplay. Yeah.
Okay.
Or a stage play.
And primarily known as a writer? Does that matter?
No, actually, okay. Because some wrote, well, Shirley Chisholm, for example, mm-hmm. in Buffalo, she's known as the first black congresswoman, but she wrote a very good political autobiography called Unbought and Unbossed.
And that's in Buffalo? Her gravesite is in Buffalo?
She's in one of the mausoleums. Kind of ornate mausoleums in Buffalo at Forest Lawn Cemetery.
What did it mean to you to go there?
Well, I feel a great deal of respect. I mean, it was all uphill for her. It was uphill for her going into the state legislature in the first place and then running for Congress. And, she stayed in there, I think, until her health started to go. And she's born in New York City, and she was raised partly in Barbados. But she's buried in Buffalo, I think, because her husband was a businessman in Buffalo, her second husband. And she taught up here off and on, I think, at the University of Buffalo and maybe at Canisius. I'm not quite sure of that. But I know she taught in Buffalo on the college level for a little bit. Yeah.
So there's a writer in the gravesite of the first black congresswoman. Mm-hmm. And by the way, this being Black History Month, if you think about place-based learning, mm-hmm. if you were interested in creating sort of a short list of gravesites of important, prominent, influential black writers that you've visited their gravesites, mm-hmm. you could do that via Steve's site. Mm-hmm. I want to ask both of you about place-based learning. Is that a good way, you think, to kind of commune and think about the work that, for example, if you were making a theme of Black History Month?
Well, it was for me. There's, for example, until I started this, I didn't know about Austin Stewart. A lot of Rochesterians know about Austin Stewart, but I didn't. I found his grave in Canandaigua. He was born in slavery in 1793. And the plantation owner sold out and moved all the slaves up to the Genesee Valley. It was still legal here at the time. Some manumission society people got him out of slavery, gave him some starting money. He was he owned a food market in Rochester for a little while, And he wrote a book called 22 Years a Slave, 40 Years a Free Man. It's a fine book. He's very eloquent.
Austin Stewart. In fact, we had an email from a listener named Joel who said, what about that famous a businessman and a black man born into slavery who buried in Canandaigua. That must be Austin Stewart.
That's him.
So there you go. Where in Canandaigua, by the way?
In West Avenue Cemetery. It's easy to find when you're driving south from the thruway into Canandaigua. You'll see West Avenue on your right. Turn right. Just a little ways down on your right is the cemetery, and you go right in the front entrance, and you'll see his spire. There's a family plot and a spire there. He's there with his wife.
Chris Clemens, and your work for creating your blog, Exploring Upstate, have you become more of an advocate for place-based learning?
Yeah, absolutely. I guess that I would follow that up with by saying if it's right for someone. I know that me personally, sitting in a classroom, I was never a great student growing up. It wasn't how I connected with information to have someone standing in front of a room and throwing out information at me. For me, it's easier for me to retain not just knowledge, but also have, again, some sort of physical connection to that place. That helps me retain that knowledge. So being able to read about something and then go see it in person and stand where that history actually took place, I think is important for me. It might not be the case for everybody, but it's definitely changed who I am and what my understanding of this region that we call home.
Yeah, I think I would probably put myself in that same category. Steve, do you feel closer to the work of the writers when you visit their graves? Does it change how you feel more connected to them?
That's an interesting question. I'd have to say yes. I've certainly read more of their works than I did of those that I already knew. I've read more of their works since.
Well, you had to do some James Fenimore Cooper reading.
You bet.
You hadn't read James Fenimore
Cooper.
Him.
I'm sorry to say, but I hadn't. Well, I have now.
Yeah. Which, by the way, not to interrupt you, James Fenimore Cooper is buried where?
In Cooperstown, but not very many people know about his daughter, Susan Augusta Fenimore Cooper, whose book Rural Hours is a wonderful book of. She was a naturalist, and a very observant one, and she influenced Henry David Thoreau. Hmm.
James Fenimore Cooper's works that you did take the time to read, what stands out to you now? Anything you want to recommend?
Well, The Last of the Mohicans is the best of the Leatherstocking novels, I think. And of course, I'd have to recommend that. You have to spend time with him. I mean, it's armchair stuff.
Armchair stuff?
You have to stay in the chair for a long time and just settle in, and then it's very comfortable reading.
Do you read one book at a time, or do you multiple?
I wish I could do that. I can't. I usually have two or three books.
See, I can't do that. I need to plow through one.
That's a good thing.
Keep my focus. Mm-hmm. That's a good thing?
I think so.
Because I have a stack. I always have a stack of books I want to get to, sometimes for work, sometimes for pleasure, sometimes for pleasure that I rope into work. But it has to be one at a time for me.
Mm-hmm.
You have several going.
Well, one novel, one nonfiction, a book of poetry.
I mean, eventually I'm going to get to the book that Chris Clemens loaned me. See, I mean, like, I have this stack.
That's a great book.
Do you read one at a time or multiple?
No, currently I have five books.
Five books?
Yeah, five books going. Yeah.
There you go, man.
Yeah.
Wow, five books. We were just, by the way, talking about Austin Stewart, and Douglas in Rochester wanted to share a quick note on that. Go ahead, Douglas.
Yes, February 15th is the 150th anniversary of the death of Austin Stewart, and partly in response to that, there's a group of people that are restoring his tombstone in Woodlawn Cemetery, West Avenue Cemetery in Canandaigua, and there's going to be a program on that same day, February 15th, at the Ontario County Historical Society, 1 p.m., which is going to expand upon the life of Austin Stewart. Prior to his coming to Rochester, he actually lived out in Ontario County in Farmington. And it's possible that he participated in the 1816 construction of the Farmington Quaker Meeting House, which many of us are in the process restoring to its original configuration from that era when it was so important in abolitionist history and so forth. So February 15th, 1 p.m., Ontario County Historical Society.
Douglas, thank you for the note on that.
Yeah, thank you.
That's
great.
Great timing. And you see what you're doing? Mm-hmm. You're opening up these connections all across our upstate region here. We're talking to Stephen Huff, the creator of the In Our Home Ground blog. It's inourhomeground.wordpress.com. He visited maybe, what, 36 sites or so, 60 or so writers, poets, screenplay and teleplay writers, their grave sites. Some names you know immediately, the Mark Twains of the world. Some that you may know a little bit about, but not much. It's fascinating stuff. Chris Clemens is here as well. He's the creator of the Exploring Upstate blog, which explores everything but cemeteries. And so we're the Voltron of upstate bloggers. We put it all together here. some feedback here. Tom writes to us and says, this is a fascinating conversation. We really do need to sort through the process, meaning, and rituals around death. And Joe writes to us and says, was wondering if Steve contacted Rod Serling's daughter, Anne, when he found the grave. I know she lives in Ithaca and has been to Rochester.
I tried. I didn't know she lived in Ithaca. I tried to connect with her on the internet, and I wasn't successful. There was several websites that I thought I could connect with her with. I'll give it another try. Yeah.
Now, Mount Hope is the site of well, I mean, it's a huge cemetery. It's the site of the most in Rochester in terms of writers.
I think so. There's one individual in there. Well, there's Adelaide Crapsey, of course, the poet, and her father, Algernon Crapsey, and Lewis Henry Morgan, the anthropologist, and Elizabeth Hollister Frost, novelist, and of course, Frederick Douglass. There is one individual that I've included there who was not a writer. His name is Edward Crone. And he was in World War II, and he was in Dresden when it was bombed. He did not survive the war, but his fellow prisoner of war was Kurt Vonnegut, who modeled Billy Pilgrim on Edward Crone.
Wow, what a story.
Yeah.
Is that, and so Edward Crone is at Mount Hope.
He's at Mount Hope. Yeah, he's easy to find. You go right in the main entrance, turn left, and when you come to the first corner on the right, the Crone family plot is there. It's a very modest stone.
It's still a pretty big cemetery. I don't know how easy you think it is.
196 acres.
Yes. Just go right in and turn left, and there it is. There's Edward Crone.
Well, that's right.
It turns out that's actually true. Where did you know the Vonnegut story from, by the way? Did you just happen to know that over the years?
Rosemary Mancini, who used to be one of the people that had the arts and lecture series here in Rochester. She became an Episcopalian minister in Boston, and I found one of her sermons online in which she was talking about Edward Crone. And she said that when they had Kurt Vonnegut in for the arts and lecture, they told him, Billy Pilgrim is buried over here. And he said, oh, no. He said, I saw him buried. We made a suit for him out of paper because there was no cloth. And they said, no, actually, his family had him exhumed and brought to Rochester and buried in the family plot here. So they took him over to Mount Hope. They waited at the gate while he went in and sat with him and had a cigarette for a while. And then when he came back to the car, she said heavily, that ends World War II for me, finally.
Wow, what a story.
That's a great story.
I'm glad I asked. I also want to reveal a little bit about myself that's going to disappoint Stephen Huff. Because I learned years ago writing about wine that there's no reason to fake it. You know, when you start writing about wine, you're going to encounter people who've tasted all these wines from around the world. It's very expensive stuff. Right. And there's just no reason for me to fake all the first growths I've never had. I'm not made of money. And but there are certain writers who will fake it because they want to sort of be in the club.
Sure.
So on this program, I try not to fake what I don't know. And I haven't read Adelaide Crapsey's stuff. And you said, of course, Adelaide Crapsey, as if everyone should know the name.
Well,
I want you to know, I have a lot of work to do.
Her face is on one of those banners along Mount Hope as you approach the cemetery. She, according to one critic, is the only American poet who actually invented an original stanza form. It's called a cinquain. And it was it was influenced by haiku and tanka forms, Japanese tanka form.
Wow.
And she died before she was ever published. There's some say that her father's troubles had caused her to die sooner, but I don't think so. Her father was brought to trial in a heresy trial by the diocese, the Episcopal diocese. They actually moved the trial to Batavia, like you'd move a criminal trial now. And it was it had national and even international attention. He was preaching far beyond the tenets of the church at that time. Very, very liberal guy, and he was defrocked. That was the end of the trial. And but I don't think that she was distraught, but that didn't. I don't think that caused her death. She that happened in 1906. Her tuberculosis showed up in 1908. And that was after she went on a walking tour of Wales with her father. In fact, her disease, it was a death sentence then. But it took so long to really develop that she thought she had been misdiagnosed. Mm. And then finally it reared its head, and she died in 1914. But she went ahead and finished college. She was teaching at Smith, and then it came back.
Yeah. But by the way, I don't know how Chris feels about the term. I suspect you feel similar to Stephen in that Stephen writes on your website that you're not a historian,
yeah.
That you don't try to do anything but other than document your experiences, yeah. and share what you have learned.
Just a writer.
Just a writer, but not a historian.
No.
You sound like a historian.
I'm not a historian by discipline. I'm not a scholar either.
Yeah, and let me also say, I think that's very respectful of historians who work very hard at their craft and trade, and our world needs them.
I couldn't tie their shoes.
So how do you feel about the term, Chris?
Yeah, I have a strong reverence for history, and I try to understand it as much as possible from an objective standpoint. But I don't know that it would be fair for me to call myself a historian. I mean, my degree is in health. But I'm fascinated by our past and how that's affected how we've gotten to where we are today in all areas of our life. So I don't even know if it's fair to say that I'm a writer. I noticed earlier when you were laying out your criteria for what graves to visit, bloggers were not in there.
Blogging is writing.
I think it probably is. There probably aren't a ton of bloggers who have passed away at this point. Maybe the platform is so young. That maybe that's part of it.
Maybe. I actually think we had a show a few years ago about the death of blogs.
I remember that.
But it was really about the death of sort of the Andrew Sullivan type blogs. I have a blog and every day I'm just going to write some stuff and you're going to come read it.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I think that the specialized stuff, mm-hmm. is where we have seen things settle in, and the really good specialized stuff gets traction and is, I think, vital. You agree there?
Mm-hmm. I hope so. Yeah. I think part of it is blogging as a platform allows people to tell stories in a manner that we normally wouldn't be allowed to. So Steve and I both write a lot of stuff about history. We're not being published in peer-reviewed journals, but we still, out of reverence for that history, have an opportunity to tell those stories in the way that we experience them and understand them. So.
Well,
yeah, I think so.
I'm going to spend as much time in the last 8 minutes or so going over some of the other names. Louise Brooks,
mm-hmm.
writer.
Well, she was a movie star, but she wrote one of the best books that's still in print and still highly respected, one of the best books on the silent era. And it's called Lulu in Hollywood. It's a very, very good book.
I think in a past program, producer Megan Mack hosted the program when I was out and talked to Louise Brooks, of which producer Megan Mack is a big fan, if I'm remembering correctly. So what is the grave set like?
Just another plaque in the ground, level with the ground, like Carl Sagan's and Rod Serling's and Henry Clune's. They can mow right over it. You don't have to you don't have to stop and clip around it because it's,
I actually think there's something sort of really nice and egalitarian about the fact that most graves are not big mausoleums. Though I don't begrudge, for example, Lewis Henry Morgan or anybody who have more ornate sites, mm-hmm. because there's different reasons for that. But I do think there's something that speaks to the egalitarian nature of mankind.
I think so. Her grave gets decorated too, by the way. Yeah. roses and things like that.
By fans.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So Louise Brooks is another name on the list. We've mentioned Arch Merrill. Obviously, Frederick Douglass, and this time of year more than ever, I think. Mm-hmm. In fact, we're right near his birthday, or at least a chosen birthday, mm-hmm. that would be an appropriate time. So you've been there, Chris?
Of course, yeah.
Okay, so can you both give us a sense for, number one, where to find it, and what you experience when you're there?
His grave and Susan B. Anthony's are the two most visited graves there, obviously, mm-hmm. wouldn't you say?
Yeah, absolutely. Mm. Yeah, in fact, I think there are two of the few graves that actually have signs near the trail markers that say, you're headed in the right direction. So I think that speaks to the popularity of those.
Yep.
And they're very helpful in the office there. There's a map. I'll take you right to it. It's a short walk.
Okay.
Mm. I've always been struck by we use the word egalitarian, the modesty of Susan B. Anthony's grave in comparison to the legacy that she's left. Mm-hmm. And those things always surprise me. And you can compare them to, and I don't want to get off the topic of authors, but you can start comparing them to other burial sites like Rick James, since we mentioned that one in Buffalo, just has this really interesting marble stone with a picture of him etched into it with a big bass guitar. So it's interesting to think about how much the person who's buried there has had an impact on what they want on their tombstone or what kind of tombstone.
Rick James?
Oh, yeah, the Rick James. Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. I didn't know that.
Yeah, he's right around the corner from Millard Fillmore and right in that same cemetery.
How about that?
Right near the Skedaddy Creek.
Yeah.
Oh, interesting.
So one of the things that I loved about Steve's blog was I kept reading these things and thinking, oh, my God, I know that person. I had no idea that they were buried there.
Yes.
And it goes on and on. Jane Roberts was one that that Steve turned me on to. I was familiar with the Seth books, which were out of Elmira. She's been dead for decades and still has an incredible following. I had no idea that she's buried in Ontario right over the Webster border. I grew up in Webster.
But you may find yourself also wondering a couple of things here. Doug writes to us and says, Evan, not to be macabre, but no one got cremated. So,
oh yeah.
So there are some great writers from
Louise Brooks
from New York who, but she has a gravesite though.
Yeah.
She has a gravesite.
Yeah.
Are there any writers who do not have gravesites? Well, there's a whole section you have that you're going to be working on called, They Were Here Too, I think.
Yes.
They Were Here Too. L. Frank Baum, mm-hmm. Wizard of Oz, for example,
that's right.
Not buried in New York State.
Not buried in New York State. I mean, he's out in California near Hollywood, I think. Yeah,
but he only lived here for a couple years. I think he moved away as a child. Mm-hmm. For people who are wondering and listening, L. Frank Baum wrote The Wizard of Oz and was born in Chittenango in central New York.
Well, his mother-in-law was Matilda Jocelyn Gage, who in Fayetteville, who's buried in Fayetteville, and she's the author of Women, Church, and State. And she was also one of the co-authors of the big history of women's suffrage that Susan B. Anthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Matilda Jocelyn Gage and one other person wrote.
So, Steve, in the last couple of minutes here, you set out to create in our home ground, not knowing exactly how long it would take you or maybe thinking it wouldn't take as long as it has.
Mm-hmm.
What else is on the list? Where do you want to go next?
Well, I still have the whole Hudson Valley to do.
Are there some writers buried there?
See? Lowell Thomas. There's Hannah Arendt is down there. Quite a few people down there. Yeah.
I kind of like how Steve uses the construction "is down there."
I mean, down there, down the river.
But the person's gone in terms of, we think of it, this person has died. But you say that person is there. And I actually love that because when you go to a gravesite, that is where they are, right?
I guess that's how I feel when I go to John Gardner's grave in Batavia. I feel very strong. I knew his family. I was friends with his family. And if I go to his grave, I feel his presence there.
Do you have any final thoughts for listeners about not just making trips like this to see the gravesites of great writers or people who made imprints on our society, but also just our own relatives, that we often don't do that. We often don't go to the gravesites.
We should. It gives us a better sense of ourselves, I think.
Do you find yourself doing that more often since you started this project?
Oh yes, oh yes. A lot of my relatives are buried in Attica, where I grew up, and I like going there now. It's made me think. It's made me visit my family.
And sometimes just to kind of clean up the site too. You know,
yes.
I mean, time
yeah.
takes a toll. Mm-hmm. How do you feel about it, Chris?
I think whether it's visiting a relative or someone who I've felt is an important person, like an author, a lot of it for me is just going and paying respect to that person and saying, really appreciate everything you've done, and maybe taking a selfless moment to go and, in a sense, visit someone else where they will forever be.
I think the idea and the work is beautiful, and I'm really glad you've been here, Stephen Huff. He's the creator of In Our Home Ground. It's inourhomeground.wordpress.com. Check it out, and I think, like me, you're going to find yourself just kind of reading, seeing the pictures, thinking about it, maybe thinking about your own visits that you might make. So thank you. Thanks for taking the
time. Thanks for having us on.
And 1 week from today, Brighton Public Library, 12:30, if you want to check out a presentation from Stephen Huff on that. Chris Clemens, where are we going to find Exploring Upstate?
You can find it online at www.exploringupstate.com.
Thanks for coming in.
Yeah, thanks,
thanks
for
to both
me.
Of you. Great conversation. Our thanks to Rob Braden, the engineer. Megan Mack is the producer of Connections. And when we say member-supported public radio, you are a member, aren't you? This is the week to do it. It's our winter membership campaign. And if you are not a member yet, wxxinews.org. You can do it in 90 seconds. We will talk to you tomorrow.